Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining me. I'm the Porkmeister. This is Life on Planet Porky. And, of course, at the other end of this line in our virtual studios, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Good morning, Miss Jones.
Good morning, Mr. Parry. How are we today?
Pretty good indeed, thank you. Pretty good. A pretty active weekend and all that. But I think I've had an active weekend. I think the bloke who's going to be most active for the rest of this week and probably the rest of his life is old Boris Johnson, because I think the vultures are circling, or the woods are burning or something. But to me, he looks like a man who's been floored. The opinion polls are now going against him. He's facing a backbench rebellion because half of Parliament thinks that the impositions he's put on our life are just too strong. And on top of all that, rumours swirling that all is not well with his new young mother of his child, not his bride yet. Carrie, what do you make of it all?
It's speculation, isn't it? I mean, who really knows anything of this? Well, that's true. That is true. Ooh. But, I mean, he doesn't look well in pictures. I've seen the front of Private Eye, this most recent issue, for example,
yes,
has side-by-side pictures, hello, goodbye is the caption.
Second wave, it's very funny.
That's right. He looks distinctly less well, shall we say, in the right-hand picture than he does in the left-hand picture.
Yeah.
Look, she's just been on holiday with her girlfriends and their little baby Wilfred, Lake Como in Italy, and there was much was made of that. You know, how dare she go on holiday when the country is collapsing? Well, I mean, people go on holiday, right? She has a right to go. She's not running the country. He is.
Well, just imagine if he'd gone with her. You know, everybody said,
well, he couldn't take the risk, could he?
Exactly. I mean, it's so ridiculous, you know. Everybody's saying that, if they split up and all that. Just imagine if he'd said, I'm taking 4 days off to take my mother of my child and my child on holiday to Lake Como in the middle of the pandemic.
Yeah, well, there's no way. But I've got a friend, actually, who works at Whitehall. She's very highly placed.
Oh, yes.
And she tells me that Carrie is the power behind the throne.
Really?
That she's very powerful indeed, and that Boris doesn't move a muscle without her approval.
Yes.
I'm inclined to believe that, because she looks like a ball breaker.
Well, not only that, but I, first of all, look at her background. She's had influence in all the jobs she's had. That's why she's been, you know, she's worked in government offices, hasn't she? Ministers' offices and all that. But secondly, I believe that she is far more woke than Boris is. And I think an awful lot of influence on some of the decisions he's making are coming from her.
Oh, probably on all of them.
Yeah.
I think she's the one who has him banged to rights.
Yeah.
You know, all his previous women have sort of simpered and sucked up to him a little bit, but this one is taking no nonsense.
Yeah.
I actually rather admire her, I have to say.
Yeah, I admire her, but I don't like the pillow talk power. I think there's an awful lot of pillow talk power in Obama's administration in America, certainly in the Clinton administration, and you can go back as far as, you know, sort of Clementine Churchill and Eleanor Roosevelt, to see the influence that spouses can have on the the person in power. I say the person, not the man, because of course we've had two female prime ministers, but you never felt with a female prime minister that their husband, you know, Dennis, and whoever Mrs. May's husband was, had any influence at all.
Phil, wasn't it? I mean, nope. I think it works. It doesn't work the other way around with the men. I think they tend to be sort of a bit wet,
really.
But this is the old cherchez la femme syndrome, isn't it? It's long been the case throughout history. Yeah. So I don't see why it should be any different now.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, for what it's worth, I think that we're in a ridiculous situation now. I think we're closed down to a ridiculous extent. A quarter of the country's now turned down. Two thirds of Wales is locked down. I think it's so stupid and ridiculous because only 0.01% of the country is affected by it. And I don't mean people dying. I mean dying or affected by it. 0.01%. And hospitals are half empty. I think it's mad. I think we're strangling ourselves.
But the rate is going up and up and up.
The rate is not going up at the pace that the doommonger scientists said. They said last Monday it would go up and increase by 10,000 a day. It's not increasing by anything like that. And at the start in March, I'm sorry if I sound like I'm hectoring you, Miss Jones, because I don't.
Well, you do a bit.
In March, there were 100,000 cases a day. It's now down to way under 10,000 a day. And I think it's ludicrous. I think we've got to get out there and face it.
It's on the rise again, and they can't take any chances with people's lives.
Well, what happens
that's the bottom line, isn't it?
What happens when the economy collapses? You know, when British Airways stops flying? I mean, God, I don't know. It's also gloomy and doomy. And
well, a second lockdown for London is certainly on its way.
What's that madman Sadiq Khan, the mayor? He wants to destroy London. He's already tried to destroy it by virtually banning cars from, you know, most roads in the city centre. He now wants to close down the economy of London. He's mad. He's a madman.
You know this personally?
Sorry?
You do know this personally?
Well, you only got to look at him. You only got to look at his actions. Anybody, you
know, I think, let's not be too harsh. I do feel that the overriding decisions are for our own good, frankly. And I do know people who've become very sick indeed with this disease. The people who wind me up the most are these anti-vaxxers and these conspiracy theorists and deniers who are trolling into Trafalgar Square and causing mayhem, saying that the virus doesn't exist. Yeah, obviously it does, so they should all shut up.
I agree with that. I had a bloke on a radio show I was doing at the weekend started spouting off about Bill Gates, you know, and conspiracy theories and all that. We just had to shut him down because he's a madman. Yes, yeah. People are sick, but people are also sick from flu. Seven times as many people have been admitted to hospital with flu than with the vaccine. Anyway, look, we could talk about this all day and we shan't, because what we try to do on Planet Porky is bring sweetness and light. And sweetness and light seems to be a little bit absent in the way that we're all responding to Meghan and Harry's latest blockbuster announcement.
Well, it's absolutely wild, isn't it? I mean, this Netflix thing, I presume you're talking about.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And didn't we speculate a few weeks ago
certainly.
We do a lot of that, yeah. But I think a few weeks ago, didn't we say that there would be some big Princess Diana expose coming? I think that is what they're building up to.
Yeah, well, I think you could well be right. You've got it right all the way along with Meghan and Harry. But I tell you what, I saw a headline in the Sunday Telegraph yesterday, and it said absolutely everything that I've been thinking about, and I'm not clever enough to put it into words, but I've got it here, and it says, where does Harry fit into Meghan's master plan?
Yeah, it hit the nail on the head, didn't it?
I mean brilliant.
He's out of his depth in California. He looks miserable as sin.
Yeah.
He's adrift. And they made the point that he could have achieved so much for this country, for the Commonwealth, for the military. But he's been used and he's been duped.
Yeah.
And I think he's her puppet.
Yeah.
And I dread to think where this is going to end, because Harry is not happy.
No, I totally agree. You can see it on his face. I totally agree with you. I think he's just lost in space. I mean, he has so cut off everything that was traditional to his life in such a brutal and speedy way. There's no way back for him. And I think the morning he wakes up in his £11 million mansion in wherever it is in California and suddenly thinks, hang on, I'm in exile now. I can't go back. I don't know what he's going to do with the rest of his life. Do you? Will she dump him at some stage?
I don't think so, because it does appear to be all part of her master plan. So the two things she had to get in place very swiftly, she had to have the royal wedding, the royal seal of approval.
Yeah.
She then had to have a baby very quickly.
Right.
Oh, good. And look, lo and behold, it's a boy.
Yeah.
So now she's cemented into Harry's existence. Mm. I think she wouldn't cut her nose off to spite her face by now dumping him.
Yeah.
What for?
Well,
you know, there's still a tenuous royal connection that could still be revived at some point.
Yeah, but you see, that could get worn out in 3 or 4 years, and then she might think, this needs reviving. And I can see her going off and marrying, you know, a massive Hollywood star or some, you know, the American football hero or something like that. You know what I mean? I think
she's not getting any younger.
No.
You know, a woman into her 40s, as she'll be by then, is...
Yeah.
You know, it's not as desirable as a 25-year-old.
It didn't stop the Duchess of Windsor, did it, eh? All those years.
Well, that's true.
Serial adulterer. Sorry, serial divorcer and marrier, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was.
That's right.
And there were. I read a great book about her some years ago, and there were rumours about her that she wasn't actually into men at all.
Oh, really? Am I?
Goodness me. Nothing surprises us, does it?
Yeah, goodness me, Miss Jones. You know, you don't have to pull them out the hat, don't you? Shock our listeners on this.
I do my best.
This family-friendly podcast, which incidentally, you know, got me into a bit of trouble of our last one. And just because I mentioned very briefly, you know, a brief liaison with, you know, a lady some decades ago, and everybody accused me of being salacious.
Well, you had been on the source, and I think you did reveal it rather more than you had intended to.
What do you mean I've been on the source? How terrible.
I can't tell you how many emails I got from people going, was he pissed?
Well, that's a bit harsh. That's very harsh indeed.
Well, I've kind of earned the right to ask you outright.
Well, the answer to that is no, of course. Now then, what I was going to say is that today it is the birthday of, as we record, of Miss Brigitte Bardot. Who is 86 years of age. Did she sort of disappear from public life about 50 years ago, never to be seen again, because she lay down in the sun too long and her face became literally like a bag of old prunes?
Well, she had various procedures done, didn't she?
And I don't know.
You know, I think the rule of thumb is if you've had procedures, you don't then lie in the sun because it melts.
Oh,
All that plastic in there, and I think it crystallizes under the cheekbones and that kind of thing. She does look horrendous.
Yeah, I know.
And I think that's one of the drawbacks of being a great beauty in one's youth, because it's only going to go one way. So there's a lot to be said, actually, for being sort of fairly plain and ordinary as a young woman,
really?
Because you're going to get more interesting with age. If the thing about you is not your face.
Yes.
You know, if that is not the way the world defines you, then you can sort of get away with aging, I think.
Yeah, I suppose you could, yeah. But I never quite understood what she was all about. I mean, she was just a beauty. She wasn't an actress, was she? Or is she?
Her sister, Mijanou Bardot, was the better actress of the two sisters, yeah. Right. But she spurned Hollywood and celebrity. She didn't really go for all that. Mm. She lived a much quieter life, not in the limelight.
Yeah.
I went down to her place in the south of France a few years ago to interview her.
Really? What's her name again?
Mijanou.
I don't think
Mijanou.
I don't think I've ever heard
of her. Mijanou Bardot, yeah.
Never heard of her. I didn't know that. Anyway, so.
Yeah, she's turned her back on it all. But of course, BB, as they used to call her, was all for the celebrity, her and Roger Vadim, wasn't it? And Club 5-on-5 down in the Saint-Tropez and so on.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Of course, a strange lot, the French, because there's been a lot of chat lately as well about Serge Gainsbourg, you know, the...
dirty old man.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But, I mean, he was an ugly guy. I don't know how he suddenly became so attractive to women. I think he made one record, didn't he? It catapulted him to world fame.
Well, it's not what you've got, it's what you do with it.
Oh, I see, right, okay, I see.
Family show.
More smutiness, Miss Jones, yeah. Well, actually, funny enough, I was going to tell you story about a French superstar. Was it Marlene Dietrich who locked herself away in a flat in Paris for about 50 years, or was it somebody else?
She was German, wasn't she?
She was German, but didn't she lock herself away in a flat in Paris, or was it?
She had an apartment in New York, just a couple of doors down from John Lennon.
Oh, did she? Oh, yeah. Right. Okay. Well, whoever this famous actress is, was Marlene Dietrich? Who was the Swedish one then, or the Scandinavian one?
Oh, I know who you mean. Yeah, I can't think of her name.
Not whoever it is, anyway. But she hadn't been seen for about 30 years, okay? And we had a correspondent on the Daily Express in those days in Paris, believe it or not. You know, we used to have correspondents all over the world, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. We had Daily Mail had one in Paris and in Milan as well.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we had one in Rome, I think, Rome and Paris. But the guy...
Ronnie Singleton was the guy. No, he was in Rome, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember him. Yeah, Ronnie Singleton, yeah. But the guy in Paris was... his first name was John. I can't remember his second name. But he was like, you know, hugely bumptious and puffed up and all that. And he suddenly rang the foreign desk and said he'd got the first interview for 30 years with Marlene Dietrich, okay? I'm pretty sure it was Marlene Dietrich. And she'd locked herself away. And said, who is it, I Want to Be Alone? That was the famous...
Yeah, there was another one, but we're far too young to remember
the
names of these people.
Yeah,
this is why it escapes us, yeah.
Yeah, I Want to Be Alone, okay?
Apparently, she never said that, whichever one it was.
Oh, really? Well, okay. Well, I'm going to, as we're talking, I'm going to find out who it is by doing some proper research.
You're doing a quick Google there. Yeah, on the quiet.
Yeah. Hang on. I want to be alone.
I'll just talk amongst myself.
No. Hang on. I want to be alone. And while we're doing this.
Can you spell that okay?
I want to be alone, yes. I want to be alone, quote. Greta Garbo. Right?
Oh, yeah, her, yeah.
There we go, Greta Garbo.
Yeah, maybe it was her who lived down the street from John Lennon. I mean, who knows?
Yeah,
we were babies.
We were babies. But so anyway, so Greta Garbo lived in this flat for 30 years in Paris, right? And what was John's name? He's dead now. He'd been dead many years. But he suddenly rang up the foreign desk, you know, fantastic revelation. He got first interview with Greta Garbo for 30 years. He somehow got access.
And she still wanted to be alone.
But he got access to the apartment block and, you know, it was very secret, like John Lennon's Dakota in New York, you know what I mean? All the important famous people there. And then he managed to, you know, weasel his way into the floor that she was on, and then he found somebody who, you know, became a go-between and eventually got in and talked to her. And this fantastic interview came over because John only spoke sort of half French, you know what I mean? And then a few hours later, it was revealed that John had had too many of the old orange things that French people drink, you know what I mean?
Well, the Pernod. He'd had a few too many Pernods.
Yeah, a few too many Pernods. And in fact, he'd been talking to Greta Garbo's cleaner.
That's even better. Yeah. I bet it was a better interview, especially if he couldn't speak French.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he could speak French, but he'd only been there 18 months and he didn't speak French when he first went there. So he had to sort of learn as he went along, you know. And you can imagine the panic when he rang up and said, you know, I'm around the court.
Got the wrong bird.
I speak the wrong one.
Exactly. And she still wants to be alone.
Yeah. And of course, people asked him questions like, well, you know, couldn't you tell from her clothes that she wasn't Greta Garbo?
Wielding a mop around the corridor, kicking the bucket in the corner.
Exactly. You know, did she still have a penny on and all this?
Oh, so funny. That's classic.
But anyway, we've all been there, I suppose, in one way or another.
Oh, no, we haven't. I don't think I've ever made a mistake like that.
No, exactly. I once, a famous story Mr. Brazil tells. We were once at the Cheltenham races and we always used to get invited into Lord Vesty's box. Lord Vesty owns Cheltenham, the race course, you know. So he always let us do our breakfast show from his personal box in the main grandstand. And Brazil tells a famous story about how I'd solicited a bottle of champagne from the champagne store, you know. We were happily sipping away at 9 o'clock, and it was the show finished at 10 o'clock. You know, and this is AM, of course. And the door opened, and in came, you know, this gentleman in morning dress, pinstriped trousers, and black jacket. My God, it's Lord Vesty. And of course, I was spluttering and mumbling about, you know, it's not your champagne. Don't worry, you know, I'm sorry, you know, we will replace it and all that kind of stuff. I was almost on my knees until the bloke announced he was actually Lord Vesty's butler, not Lord Vesty himself.
Funny.
Yeah, so I got away with that one. Anyway, there we go. Listen, I'll tell you what else happened on this day. In 1066, old King Harold copped for one in the eye at Hastings. How about that?
Was that today, was it?
Oh. Yeah, 1066. Now, I mentioned that for two reasons. Firstly, of course, it was a classic day in the history of this country. I've never been able to work out, if we got invaded by the French in 1066, why don't we speak French?
Well, that's a good question. I've forgotten all that history. It's a long, long time ago since I studied that. But I don't know. The Bayeux tapestry may hold the secrets to your question.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it was all a bit odd in those days because apparently we used to have kings. I think King Richard I, you know, Richard.
We had kings all over the country, didn't we? It wasn't just one king.
Yeah, but we had one king who lived in France and only spoke French. I think that was King Richard, who went off on the crusade, you know. So I think there was a lot of interaction, but I still have never been able to work out how we don't speak French.
And, well, we must have fought back. I mean, there was the Hundred Years' War, wasn't there,
and Agincourt.
Yeah, we must have fought back.
Must have done and told them.
We generally do. I mean, we fight them on the beaches, these guys, right, don't we?
Yeah. And the other thing I remember about 1066 is not as far back as 1066. It was the first school play I ever appeared in at school, 1066 and all that. It's a famous sort of, you know, play written by some comedian. And I was King Harold.
Did you get one in the eye?
Well, only a rubber one on my head.
Oh, let's not do rubber. This is far too early for me.
That's right, it's a family show after all, isn't it?
Family show, yeah. Family show.
Now listen, Miss Jones, if you went up to your wardrobe and started sifting through your vast attire of clothes, would you have a cardigan?
No, absolutely not. No one should wear cardigans. I think they're absolutely awful garments. They make everybody look like a care home candidate.
Right, okay.
I think everyone except a chic French girl who sort of wear these bejeweled cashmere versions. And yeah. They always look ready for sex in them, don't they?
Do they? Oh, right.
Yeah, but I think on everybody else, they just look dreadful.
Right, okay. Well, you are in tune with a lady called Aisha Vardag, who is styled as the country's top divorce lawyer, OK? A very glamorous blonde woman. And she runs a big practice, employs lots of young lawyers and all that. And she's issued a new instruction, which has got her into trouble, saying none of her staff must ever wear cardigans again. She says she's issued an edict to all the lawyers at her firm demanding a return to discreet tailoring and to absolutely ditch cardigans and not to have long hair in the office. It's either got to be tied up or cut or something like that. Do you think that's a bit of an imposition?
Well, I think it's against the law nowadays. There was a big case, wasn't there, a few years ago, about a company who asked the female employees to wear high heels.
Yes, that's right.
And there was a huge outcry because, you know, who can dictate what women wear to work? Nobody's telling the men what to wear.
Yeah.
So I think actually this Aisha Vardag has stepped over the line because you can't tell somebody what to wear anymore unless it's a uniformed environment.
Yeah.
Say you work in Marks and Spencer or something and you've got to wear, you know, the standard attire. Mm. You cannot dictate to your employees what they wear to work.
Well, this woman apparently is a huge figure in the legal world because she actually got the first ever pre-nup agreement in this country. It says here, Ms. Vardag, who rose to legal profession prominence a decade ago in a Supreme Court case that recognised prenuptial agreements for the first time in the United Kingdom. And she's issued the edict, which says, my employees must look like a pro, not a pretty young thing. I think she means professional, obviously, not a pretty young thing. She acknowledged in the email that female staff can still, of course, be discreetly sexy and colourful and flamboyant at the same time, according to your own preference, but no cardigans, no long hair.
Yeah, she's on a bit of thin ice here, I think. You know, there might be some backlash to this.
Yeah, no, it could well be. I tell you one thing I can't stand is a man in a cardigan. I think that looks even worse. Do you remember when we used to have sub-editors in newspaper?
They always wore them, didn't they? With pockets sort of weighed down with toffees and cigarettes. And
a pipe and tobacco.
Oh, yeah, a pipe. And they stank.
Yeah, they did. They all. And do you remember there was our trade magazine was called the UK Press Gazette. And there was always a column in it called The Man in the Cardigan, and it was about
that's Trump. Right. Yeah, I do remember.
But no, I totally agree. They always stank of tobacco. They usually had a pipe in their mouth. They wore glasses. They had a discoloured sort of moustache or beard or something. They were weirdos, weren't they?
And yellow fingers.
Yellow fingers, absolutely right. Usually with dirty fingernails. I don't know why.
Let's not go back there.
That was newsprint that got in there. But no, they were like failed reporters, weren't they? If you couldn't get out on the road and do it and write it and travel and get there and do the story, you settle for being a sub-editor sitting at a desk.
That's a bit harsh. People set out to be subs, didn't they?
Ripping up everybody else's copy. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porking. Miss Jones in fine form this morning, but getting a little bit frisky here and there. And this is I must remind you, Miss Jones, this is a familiar
family show.
Family show, indeed. Listen, we just talked about sub-editors, people from newspaper production rooms. Talking about journalists, there are a couple in the news at the moment for very good reasons. Mr. Andrew Neil, well known to us as the former editor of the Sunday Times and latterly a broadcaster, has announced that he is launching a new news station in this country called GB News.
Well, he has, and I think that, he was wasted by the BBC, wasn't he? I think people are generally saying, look, they didn't realise what they had.
Yeah.
I find him quite unappealing on screen, I have to say.
Yeah.
He's not my cup of tea to watch. Hmm. There's something a bit oily about him. But yes, the BBC didn't make the most of him, so now he's gone off and launched his own thing.
Yeah,
we can only say good for him.
Yeah, we can, because, you know, more competition, the better. Now, it's very interesting because two other journalists known to us, well, not known to us, but certainly known, one of them very well to you. First of all, Charles Moore looks like he's going to become the chairman of the BBC. He's a columnist for Spectator magazine and former editor of the Daily Telegraph. But the one that will have, I'm sure, sparked your interest is the news that Mr. Paul Dacre may become head of Ofcom. Please tell me about your experiences with Mr. Paul Dacre, former editor of the Daily Mail.
That's a bit disturbing, this. I mean, I tend to feel if these people retire, they should stay retired.
But he's not retired, is he? He's still chairman of Daily Mail Trust or whatever.
Yeah, but he pulled out of, you know, editor-in-chief or whatever he was for years. Why not stop? He had health issues for quite some years.
Oh, did he?
He's in his 70s. He owns a vast estate in Scotland.
He does, yeah, you're right.
Why doesn't he just go there and enjoy the rest of his life rather than continue to be obsessed with the media?
Well, because some people can't, and that includes me. I don't want to wake up in the morning and have no purpose to life, you know what I mean? Or no direction, or nothing to achieve, or nothing to reach out for. And I'm sure he feels the same. You're absolutely right. He was the editor of the Daily Mail for 26 years. He displaced the former great editor of the Daily Mail, David, what's his name?
Sir David English.
Sir David English, thank you.
Well, actually, David English died, didn't he? Quite young as well.
He died after he'd retired. He became Sir David English. Yeah. He died after he retired, sadly. But the reason he got pushed out was because Dacre was the editor of the Evening Standard, owned by the Daily Mail. And Rupert Murdoch approached him and said, come and edit the Times for me. And the Mail couldn't let him go. So they had to make David English chairman, pushed him upstairs and gave Dacre his job, and he was there 26 years.
He was a tough guy to work for. They used to call him the Doberman. You know, yeah. He would have sold his grandmother for a story. He was a very austere, stony looking guy.
Yeah.
You know, not much emotion ever crossed his face.
No, that's right. Fearsome recognition.
I stood in the lift with him more than a few times in the old building just off Fleet Street.
Yeah.
And he would stand in the lift like a statue and not even acknowledge that you were there.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not even a good morning or how are you? Yeah. And, you know, it's quite unnerving. I suppose it was all part of his act, really.
Yeah, I suppose it was. He used to have a drink once a week on a Friday evening. He'd go out on his own to a pub in Kensington, latterly where the Mail offices were, and he would stay out for an hour and a half, and then his driver would come and pick him up and take him home. And
he lived in Islington in a very nice house.
Did he? Yeah,
opposite the Albion pub, which you probably know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and not just round the corner from Lord and Lady Bollard, as we used to call.
Oh, yeah, them. That's right. Yeah, Nick and Eve. Yeah, Bollard, yeah.
Nick and Eve. Yeah.
Yeah. But I tell you a funny story. When I went to New York, the bureau boss was a guy called Brian Vine, OK? And Brian was the...
Knew him well.
Yeah, exactly. The doyen of the New York press. Yes, what's going on here? No,
that's actually a very good impersonation.
Let's get up to Syracuse and see if people are running, shall we? And then we'll go for a plate of Chinese around the corner before we have a few cocktails.
And his wife worked for Playboy.
No, it wasn't Playboy. It was...
Oh, was it Penthouse? Was it even worse? No, I thought it was... It's definitely Playboy.
No, honest to God, I tell you why. Because we were all in Costello's once and she was there. Bob Guccione, who owned Penthouse, came in and had a drink. But every Christmas, Bob Guccione, the owner of Penthouse and a very successful American publisher of sort of smut magazines, bought Beverly, who was Brian's wife, a new fur coat. She had to have an apartment just to put the fur coats in to keep them at a...
She thinks she's Yoko Ono.
Yeah, Yoko Ono, that's right, yeah. But it's very funny. Brian was such a gentleman and all that. And one time, Dacre, believe it or not, worked for the Daily Express in New York. And Vine used to treat him like, I mean, the office boy, you know what I mean? You know, right, Dacre, young Parry and I are going up to Syracuse, a bit of racing. Now, get on with that fucking feature that you've been trying to write.
Family show, come on.
I'm sorry, yeah, but that was just a direct quote, you know.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, 20 years later, Brian got sacked by Larry Lamb, another legendary Fleet Street editor. Now, Mr. Barry, he was a Yorkshireman who loved Geoffrey Boycott. Now, Mr. Barry, we're going out for dinner, and I want you to choose the wine. And if I see you select a bottle of wine, Mr. Barry, that's not fit to wash my car with, there will be a problem.
Yeah. Oh, you're wasted. You really are.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. But anyway, so Larry sacked Brian. Brian made the terrible mistake of doing an interview with a magazine. I can't remember which one it was now. It's like, you know, one of those sort of society magazines like Tatler or something like that. You know what I mean? And he had a picture of him posing, leaning on his mantelpiece with statues of his horses and a picture of his child who went to a very expensive private school in Manhattan, and quoted as saying things like, you know, I couldn't possibly go back to London now. My lifestyle here is in New York. And as soon as Larry Lamb read that, he closed down the bureau and sacked him. So it wasn't very smart. Anyway, point of my story is, long rambling story this, 25 years later, when Brian got the hoof, guess who rescued him? The man who was the editor of the Daily Mail, Paul Dacre, who he treated so badly all those years earlier.
Yeah, well, interesting. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting the way that the...
What goes around comes around.
The Fleet Street gravy train goes around, doesn't it? And
Yeah, it sure does.
I mean, that's the same everywhere. We had a bloke called Bernard Trimsley who worked at the Express. And I'm sorry now that to the listeners that we keep going on. We'll change subject in a minute. But again, Bernard was allegedly...
Speed it up.
Allegedly Fleet Street editor, News of the World, Sun and all that. And then when he got the boot from everywhere, Nick Lloyd, who was my editor, rescued him. It was just the old pals act. He just gave him a job and he just floated around the office doing nothing. Wish we could have jobs like that, don't you?
Well, it's the same thing in Downing Street, of course.
Of course it is, yeah, yeah. Now, Miss Jones, you are often a critic of my culinary desires. culinary, I said. And I have a report here which is going to make you literally eat your words. Because it says, frozen fruit and veg is best, shoppers told. Frozen and canned fruit and vegetables are often better, cheaper and tastier than fresh versions, despite their less trendy image. What about that?
We've always known this, haven't we?
Have we?
Yeah, of course. The preservation process captures and contains the nutrients and the vitamins. And you can get as much vitamin C in a cup of frozen peas as in 10 fresh oranges.
Oh, so why do you always criticise me when I say, oh, yes, I've got some frozen sprouts in the freezer. I'll just get those.
I don't. You've never talked to me about your frozen sprouts. Not a euphemism.
Right, OK. But so often, you know, I've been attacked and barracked over the years. I said, look, I live alone. It's easy to go to the freezer, get something out, and 10 minutes later, you know, there's a meal on the table. Oh, frozen food, it's disgusting, and all that kind of stuff.
No, you're fine with frozen. I think you're better off with frozen, frankly, than with a lot of tins of stuff.
Ah, no.
But the occasional tin is not going to be a problem. The only trouble with tinned fruit is it does tend to come in a lot of syrupy sugar, which, of course, isn't good for you.
Right, well, I've got more news for you. Here's another report. Given the depressing state of world news, has there ever been a better time to take a Marie Kondo approach to stocking your pantry? Who is Marie Kondo, one asks? Well, I don't know, but some real...
Well, she's this bird who advises chucking everything away and living in a zen-like existence with no clutter around you.
Oh, is she? Oh, is she not? Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, she says, while pondering the benefits provided by... Hang on. This month, which the consumer group reported frozen vegetables contain more nutrients. We've done that. But also... there's a huge range of online stores now shipping hermetically sealed produce in tins from places all over the world, and it's absolutely great food. How about that?
Well, as long as it hasn't got a high sugar content, that's my only point to make.
I tell you what, I didn't know this, but you'll know this having lived in France. The French, contrary to popular conception, love their ready meals. It's just that they buy them in tins, right? In tins. So, you know, we'd get a ready meal in a usually a black plastic tray with a piece of cellophane over it, wouldn't we?
Yeah, and those are terrible for the environment.
Horrible. I totally agree. But it says the French contrary to popular consumption, don't it in tins. The cookbook writer Alex Hollywood, never heard of him. It's not the
It's not Paul Hollywood,
no,
is it?
No, not Paul Hollywood, no. Says,
oh, it's her. Maybe it's the wife, the ex-wife.
Yeah, it could be.
I think it is the ex-wife.
I think you're absolutely right. The cookbook writer Alex Hollywood says that she rarely leaves France without a bootful of tinned duck confit.
What does she have in the other boot?
I don't know. But what is duck confit?
Oh, confit of duck is a lovely dish. When the duck leg, it's usually the leg, which is quite big, it's slow cooked for several hours so that it boils right down and the meat is very tender and it falls off the bone.
Oh.
It's absolutely delicious. You can sometimes have it with a sort of cherry sauce. It's divine.
And would you have it?
Oh, I have it often. If it's on a menu, I always choose it.
No, out of a tin?
Yeah.
Would you? But you.
Yeah, why not?
And you were always attacking me for eating.
No, I'm not always attacking you. I just said is as long as there's not a high sugar content.
Yeah, well, they don't put sugar in kippers. I eat my kippers out of a tin.
They might do. They might do for all you know. No. You just got to check the labels.
No, I get my tinned kippers in sunflower oil from Morrison's on the fish counter. Oh, no, sorry, on the fish shelf.
They sell tins on the fish counter. No, that's unusual.
No, on the fish shelf. On the fish shelf.
Yeah, get it right, Mike.
Anyway, she says, I just have it roasted with duck fat chips and then I decant the rest of the fat into a jar for the Sunday roasties. So, you know, people are supporting canned food all the way through.
Yeah, and duck fat, by the way, duck fat or goose fat are absolutely brilliant for roast potatoes.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I tell you what, when you talk about duck, what I love, although I don't get it as a takeaway because it always looks too badly packaged to me, but I love the old wrapping up the old duck in the pancakes. What are they?
Oh, Peking duck. Yeah, that is lovely, isn't it?
Absolutely. I absolutely love it, honestly.
But have you ever been in Soho, you know, where all the Chinese restaurants are, and you go past those little places and they've got strings and strings of ducks all hanging up in the window?
Yeah.
And I always think, poor ducks.
Yeah, so do I. I don't like to see that. I totally agree. Now, I can imagine you will be glued to your television this evening, Miss Jones, because it's the first episode of a new talent show hosted by Little Mix, looking for the next great girl band. And do you know what? I mean, I think they're very successful, Little Mix. Good luck to them. They've made lots of money, very popular. But really, isn't it stretching the imagination to think that they could, I don't know, spot talent? Because they're actually, aren't they put together as a group rather than, you know what I mean, individually great artists?
Well, they were put together originally, but they're actually really good singers and songwriters.
Yeah.
You've got Leanne Pinnock and Jerry Thirlwall. Oh, yeah. They signed a worldwide publishing deal last year with Sony ATV Music that officially recognises them as songwriters.
Mm.
And they've launched hundreds of songs. They've got millions of followers.
Mm.
Songs like Black Magic, Shout Out to My Ex. You know, they've been going for 8 years or something. They've got chart sales into the millions.
Right.
I don't think we can say that they're talentless.
Oh, I didn't say that. I thought they was like individually packaged. But look, if I'm being harsh on them, then I apologize.
I think so, yeah.
Always been a huge defender of Spice Girls because I thought, well, you know, you can say what you like about them. They became the most famous and most successful girl group ever, didn't they? Girl band ever.
Oh, yeah, they did. But I think also that Little Mix are a sort of band for the 21st century.
Right.
You know, they're eco-conscious and they stand up for women's rights. They're very feminist.
Yeah.
Young girls are getting good, positive messages from them.
Yes. Oh, well, I'm glad about that. And if I've been unkind, then I apologise because I don't usually have a go at successful people. I usually support them. Talking about successful people, who is Alfie Beau?
Oh, well, he's a singer. My son really admires him, actually.
Right.
But he's a bit of a dirty dog, isn't he? He's sort of dumped his wife and he's been having affairs left, right and centre.
Yeah.
You look at him and you think, how? Mm. I mean, I suppose it's only because he's famous and probably loaded. And yeah, but he was one of the famous Jean Valjean in Les Miserables.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, that gives him a plus in my mind. I thought Les Miserables was brilliant. The TV version. No, I can't stand the stage version because there's too many songs in it. You know what I mean?
That is the point of a musical.
Well, yes, I suppose you're right. Yeah, but I liked the TV version, which was...
You mean the film?
The film, yeah, that's right. No, there was a TV series of it a few months ago.
Oh, was there? I missed that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, Alfie Beau is now knocking around with a 25-year-old and he's 46. Doesn't make him a bad person, does it?
It does if you met the woman behind your wife's back and you've got little kids at home waiting for you to come home and tuck them into bed.
Oh, dear. I'm talking about big stars who seem to be getting talked about at the moment. Why is Rupert Everett going around saying, you know, Hollywood dumped me and it's all so unfair?
Well, Hollywood did. I mean, his star rose, didn't he? Made film with Madonna, Julie Roberts. He seemed to be destined for great things. And then Hollywood suddenly dumped him. And I think he secretly felt that it was because he was gay.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I don't get Hollywood. I think it's so hypocritical. Hollywood is the liberal capital of the world for embracing, you know, anything that's going, really, and very open-minded and all that.
But it wasn't cool to be gay back then. And, you know, America's always been very reactionary, hasn't
it? Yes, yes. But when's back then? He doesn't look that old to me, Rupert Everett.
Well, I think he's in his 60s. He must be.
Okay.
Because I think we're talking sort of 80s. His star was in the ascendant during the 80s, and then it sort of fell off the side. But he was famously in St. Trinian's, the remake.
Oh, was he? Oh.
Yeah, he was the headmistress, I think.
Was he? The headmistress?
Yeah, it was in drag, obviously.
Yeah, I was going to say, it must have been drag, yeah. Oh, very.
I think it was a bit of a drag, actually.
It was a bit of a drag, yeah. Incidentally, talking about putting bands together, I read over the weekend that it's the anniversary of the Monkees being formed. Now, you're probably not old enough to remember the Monkees, are you, Miss Jones?
Oh, I do remember them, yeah. They were actually, they had a little cartoon TV series, didn't they?
Well, that's what it was all based about. I didn't realise till I read it, but here we go, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees.
Quick key change there, yeah.
That's right, yeah. Now, they were set up in opposition to the Beatles, right, because the Beatles are so successful and gone over and conquered America. But what I didn't realise was, I think we've mentioned before that Neil Diamond and people wrote songs for them, but I didn't realise they were put together initially, as you quite rightly say, a TV series. And it was just thought, you know, we'll put some songs in it like that. And when the TV series wasn't commissioned 15 months later, the group fell apart because there was nothing there. So they were, you know, quick come, quick go, so to speak.
They were actually good musicians. And it was quite interesting to me that David Jones, who became...
Yep.
David Bowie, who at one point was known as Davy Jones.
Oh, yeah, Davy Jones, yeah.
Had to alter his name because Davy Jones of the Monkees was the more famous at that time.
Yes, I know. Isn't that amazing? Absolutely amazing.
How things turn.
And you're talking about the lead singer, and
yeah.
He was 5'1". And prior to going to America and becoming worldwide famous as the lead singer of the Monkees, he was a jockey. And he rode horses at Newmarket in this country. He was a smashing bloke. I mean, you know.
He was a sort of Dudley Moore figure, wasn't he? Because he was pint-sized, but perfectly formed. And women absolutely loved him.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, you're absolutely right there. Talking about musicians and all that, in 1966, in this week, the Beach Boys record God Only Knows was released, okay?
Oh, what a song that is. How long have we got? I just love that song.
Paul McCartney, I read once, described it as the greatest song he's ever heard. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Well, oh, yeah. It's a perfect song. It's creative virtuosity. It's lyrical achievement. It's got a groundbreaking arrangement. It works on the sort of broad brush levels and at macro level for the nuanced enthusiast.
Yeah.
It's not your everyday 12-bar blues construction.
Yeah. Now, you see...
And it's got a story. And if you analyse the lyrics, I can see what Paul McCartney's saying here. It's just so clever. That first line,
yeah, well,
I may not always love you, but
yeah.
Long as there are stars above you. Well, there are always stars above you. So in other words, I'll love you forever. It's quite cryptic.
I don't understand it because another line...
Well, it's cryptic.
Well, another line says, if you should ever leave me... Life would go on, girl, believe me. That should say, shouldn't it? If you ever leave me, life would not go on, girl, believe me.
Yeah, but the world could show nothing to me, so what good would living do me? In other words, I cannot live without you. So it's full of little sort of apparent contradictions, which all stack up to, I can't possibly exist without you.
I see. Well,
I don't mean you. I mean,
yes,
you know.
Yes,
this
exactly.
But the orchestration is immense as well, and you've got so much in there. Harpsichords, sleigh bells, strings, French horn.
Yeah.
You've got tape strings on a drawing pinned piano. It feels so far away, and it builds and builds and builds. And of course, Hal Blaine's snare triplets for the drummers out there are just so sweet in the fade out. It is Brian Wilson at his zenith, but it's not him singing. Did you know?
No,
do you know who's singing that song?
It'll be Al Jardine, won't it?
No, it's his younger brother, Carl Wilson.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, blimey. Because there were three Wilsons, weren't there? Dennis Wilson was the drummer. He died when he jumped off his yacht in Venice Beach and never surfaced.
Well, I think he fell off. He was, one over the eight, yeah.
No, it wasn't one over the eight. I think he was an incessant coke user, wasn't he? And I think he...
Oh, yeah, a bit of everything. But the great love of his life was Christine McVie from Fleetwood Mac.
Really? Isn't that amazing? The way the world
works. You learn something every day, don't you? But of course, the whole album that this song is from, Pet Sounds, this was Brian Wilson's response to the Beatles' Rubber Soul.
Oh, was it? I thought it was a response. Oh, yeah, that's right. And but it came out at the same time as Sgt. Pepper's, didn't it? And then
I think Rubber Soul really sort of turned everybody's heads, and everybody had to come back with a response to that.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And it's fine of Paul McCartney to come and say, actually, this is the greatest song of all time.
Yeah.
Isn't that lovely coming from him?
Yeah, it's very generous to another artiste. You know, did John Lennon ever nominate a song that he particularly liked?
He nominated his own a few times, yeah, exactly. I think. His own favourite song of John's was Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite.
Golly, is that right? Because that was off Sgt. Pepper's, and that was made by George Martin's arrangements with the harpsichord piano, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was inspired actually by a poster that he found in an antique shop in Sevenoaks High Street, where I used to live. And, you know, they shot the videos, didn't they, in Knoll Park in Sevenoaks.
Yeah.
I used to go through Knoll Park every afternoon when I picked Mia up from school.
Really? Good girl. Amazing, eh? The way the world goes round. Right, OK, now, Miss Jones, I know what you're thinking about for the rest of your life, but this is a cautionary tale here. When a man 10 years her junior started chatting her up in a hotel in Antigua, makeup artist and beauty entrepreneur Ruby Hammer did what most midlife women do. She assumed he was after her daughter. That was back in 2004. Ruby, newly divorced, was 42 and older. Anyway, the point of the story is that this is a warning from a woman that when you marry a man 10 years younger, the older you get, the more you think he might be looking at other women and not you. Beware, Miss Jones.
Well, she's 58 now, Ruby. She's a really lovely woman,
really?
Actually. I like her a lot.
Yeah.
I met her at a friend's wedding and we got on famously.
What does she do?
She's a makeup artist.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. Oh, yeah, of course. I told you.
Yeah. So she's, you know, very well placed to make herself look as good as possible. But of course, at night, the makeup has to come off.
Yes, that's right. So so it's not something you'd recommend then, necessarily.
No, look, I mean, if you fall in love with somebody, if you meet somebody and it's love at first sight, everything else falls away. It doesn't matter how old you are, they are, what colour you are, you know, what you do for a living, all of that just drops away.
Yeah.
Love is love, and it's the thing we all hope for, isn't it?
Well, I don't know, really. I think I don't really hope for it.
Have you grown out of it now?
Yes, I have, yeah. I mean, it would completely wreck my life plan now if I suddenly fell in love, to be honest.
Well, you know, beware is all I can say, because it could creep up any day, unannounced, and whack you over the head.
It's not in my life plan. For what life?
No, it's not in any of our life plans, but, you know, it could still happen.
I don't think it will. I've only ever been in love once, and that was when I was between 16 and 20, and I've never felt the pang of, you know, being, you know what I mean, like Cupid's dart hit my heart ever since. So,
well, yeah, just wait and see. But people keep messaging me, by the way, about Big Brenda. What do you want to tell me about Big Brenda?
Big Brenda doesn't exist.
Oh, that's a shame, because I thought we could invite her along to our live shows.
Live shows. I had a relationship with a lady called Brenda, quite a long one, about 2 years, something like that. Beautiful woman, a really, really beautiful looking woman, dark hair. Her mother was Portuguese, so she had, you know, luscious sort of dark hair and all that kind of stuff. And a beautiful...
Was she on the large side?
No.
Why is she called Big Brenda then?
Because Alan Brazil once called her Big Brenda, just like that, and it stuck ever since. But no, she wasn't on the large size, except...
So she was slender Brenda then?
Not necessarily. She had a fabulous figure, put it that way, OK? A really fabulous figure.
Voluptuous.
Voluptuous. She was...
Significant bazooms.
Yes, that's right. And curvy hips and long legs. She was a really gorgeous lady, and she was a lovely personality as well. And our careers just went in different directions. But, you know,
So one minute she doesn't exist, the next minute your careers went in different directions.
Yeah, but she was never Big Brenda, if you see what I mean. Mr. Brazil called her that once, and it just stuck with...
So she is a real person?
Oh, yes, a real person, yeah.
I get it. Okay. So we could get her along to the live shows?
I think she lives in the north of England, so we'd have to go to the north of England.
We could send a cab.
We could send a cab, yeah. But, you know, I don't think necessarily those things are good to revive, because if you revive them, you don't know what to do next, you know what I mean?
What we should do is have a show when we invite all our exes to be the audience and see how that pans out.
Yeah, okay. In my case, you'd need a big theatre. But anyway, there we are. Right.
I'll do with a shed down the garden.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Okay, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. Be lovely talking to you again. And
Really average.
Yeah, really average. That's for, and to all our listeners out there, thank you very much indeed for listening. And from Planet Porky, we'll be back with you again very soon. I was King Harold in Genesis.
Did you get one in the eye?
Well, only a rubber one on my head.
Oh, let's not do rubber. This is far too early for me.
That's right, it's a family show after all, isn't it?
What do you want to tell me about Big Brenda?
Big Brenda doesn't exist.
Oh, that's a shame, because I thought we could invite her along to our live shows.
Live shows. I had a relationship with a lady called Brenda, quite a long one, about 2 years, something like that. Beautiful woman, really, really beautiful looking woman, dark hair. Her mother was Portuguese, so she had, you know, luscious sort of dark hair and all that kind of stuff. And a beautiful...
Was she on the large side?
No.
Why is she called Big Brenda then?
Because Alan Brazil once called her Big Brenda, just like that, and it stuck ever since. But no, she wasn't on the large size, except...
So she was slender Brenda then?
Not necessarily. She had a fabulous figure, put it that way, OK? A really fabulous figure.
Voluptuous.
She was...
Significant bazooms.
Yes, that's right, and curvy hips and long legs. She was a really gorgeous lady, and she was a lovely personality as well, and our careers just went in different directions. But, you know,
So 1 minute she doesn't exist, the next minute your careers went in different directions.
Yeah, but she was never Big Brenda, if you see what I mean. I tell you one thing I can't stand is a man in a cardigan.